This is Digital Story Podcast number 965, September 17th, 2024. Today's theme is Let's Get Real. A smartphone only in Alaska is ridiculous. I'm Derek Story. Alaska is geological wonder, seafaring history, indigenous culture, gold rush, hardship, wildlife, and wild west. It is truly bigger than the life most of us have ever experienced. Alaska is awe-inspiring, soaked to the bone, and warmed by salmon bisque and fresh baked bread. And if you're ever lucky enough to visit, take the right gear. And I don't mean just a rain jacket and boots. I'll explain more on today's TDS Photography Podcast. I hope you enjoy the show. So it's great to be back from a wonderful trip in Vancouver, BC and Alaska. And I enjoyed everything. I really did. And the thing that I liked about it was that I got to see so many different conditions, so many different sides, so many different locations. Some days we had absolutely beautiful weather in Glacier Bay, for example, which is a place where you want great weather. Other days it just rained and rained and rained. And that was fine because I had the gear for it and I had great locations. I was out exploring and the rain didn't bother me at all. And then I could always just come back and warm up and dry off and have a great meal and then do it again. It was fantastic. I feel very refreshed. I have lots of great pictures and I met a lot of really terrific people. Before I get to the camera gear, which is the main focus of today's show, I do want to talk a little bit about Alaska in general. Because if you're thinking about going, there are some things you should know. First of all, if you're cruising, which is a great way to go, especially if you do the Inside Passage, I highly recommend it. But there are a few things about cruising that you should be aware of. One is make sure you have a trip that includes a day in Glacier Bay, because Glacier Bay is only accessible by water. And it is this ginormous preserve. And there's a lot of smart people that can share a lot of knowledge with you. And they actually will, if you have the right cruise line, will come onto the boat. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But you really need a captain and a crew that know what they're doing if you're going to do Glacier Bay correctly. I recommend Holland America for a lot of reasons. First of all, they've been going to Alaska longer than anyone else. At least that's what the locals tell me. They work closely with the U.S. Forest Service, the indigenous tribes, and are focused on education as well as enjoyment. Also, they get the best parking spots. And I think part of that is because of their history. When you're in Juneau, or you're in Skagway, or you're in Ketchikan, you know, those locations, you can dock in those locations. However, if you don't have the history there and you don't have preferential parking, you end up having to moor outside and then you have to tender in. Now, I'm not crazy about tendering for a lot of reasons. First of all, the little boats are very cramped. Second of all, it takes a lot of time to tender in and tender back out. The boats only hold so many people. They all crowd at the gangway. On and on and on. And if you have a full day in port, you're going to lose a lot of time tendering. And then if you want to go back, retool, and then go back out, then you're going to lose even more time. Whereas if you're docked, you basically go down the gangway and you're in the port itself and you just walk to wherever you want to go, pick up your ride, whatever you're doing. Holland America was able to dock in every destination we went to. And the other lines, Norwegian, Princess, Carnival, a lot of times had locations that were not nearly as nice. A lot of times they had to tender in. I know in Ketchikan, Norwegian has a whole separate area where they can dock, but it's like 30 minutes away from downtown. So then you have to take a bus into town, and it just wasn't great. So anyway, take a look at, it's very important that if you're doing this, that you take a look at whatever cruise line you choose, you know, where they dock, how much time they spend in port, how easy it is for you to get on and off the vessel, and those sort of things, because they really add up. They really add up a lot to either the lack of hassle or the addition of hassle, depending on which system you have. For the inside passage trips, I think if you can get a stateroom on the starboard side, that is better. And I just feel like that there is more photographable scenery on the right side. We went up through the inside passage and then turned around and then came back on the ocean. So depending on where you are on the ship, you do get to see, you know, a lot of different stuff. And port isn't bad, but there were a few instances, and our room was on the port, our stateroom was on the port, but there were a few instances where I had to go to starboard in order to get the shot that I want. Regardless of which side that you're on, make sure that you get a room with a balcony, pay the extra money to get a room with a balcony, because there is a ton of photography while you're on the ship itself. A lot of photography, especially if you're doing inside passage, because shore is close and there's a lot of interesting things, not to mention what happens at twilight and sunrise, not to mention if there are northern lights or not. You know, it goes on and on and on. And having the ability to step right outside of your stateroom and capture images is very important. A lot of really terrific shots that I have were captured from the balcony of the ship. You know, that is very important. Do not cheap out on getting a room that does not have a balcony that you can hang out on, and, you know, try to get a good position on the ship, because over the long haul, you're going to get a lot more images. When you're in port, make sure you go outside the city limits. A lot of folks won't. And, you know, like, you really notice this in places like Skagway, where you just, you know, walk out and you walk into this really cool old town, but there's a ton of people there. And, you know, they cater to the cruise ships, of course. So there's lots of services and lots of shops and places to eat, all that good stuff. And it is fun to do some street photography there and all of that. But you want to go beyond that if you're truly going to experience the area. So do some research and get some excursions led by folks who are there locally. And usually in a small van, as you can get. All the excursions I did were in small vans, and we had no more than 6 people on any excursion. And then you really get out there. You get out there and you see some stuff that you're just not going to see otherwise. And the thing is, even if you were driving yourself, or even if you hired someone to drive you while you're there, you would have to do a lot of research to really know where to go. And this happened to me time and time again, where I was just amazed at the angles and the little cubby holes and the little overlooks and all that stuff that the guy who does this every day, who lives there, does this every day, knows about. It was fantastic. So make sure that you get out there on a small group, in a small van, and really explore the outskirts of the area. And it'll pay off. It pays off big time. Plus, it's just a lot more enjoyable. The one exception to this, of course, is what I mentioned earlier, Glacier Bay, where you're on the ship the whole day, because you can't drive into Glacier Bay. I mean, we can't. You and me can't. It is accessible by vessel only. And so you go in there, and what Holland did for this was crazy. They work with the Forest Service. They work with some indigenous educators. And they come out on a ship, and they actually go alongside our ship inside the bay there early in the morning, very early in the morning. And while the two ships are moving at the same speed, they board our ship. And not only do they board our ship, they bring a bunch of stuff. They basically set up a whole visitor center up on the top deck of the cruise ship. So you have rangers up there. You have historians up there. You have members of local tribes up there. They have things to buy, they have things to share, they have things to show all up there. And while you're up there, of course, you're seeing what's going on. So you can ask questions about this glacier, that glacier, this sort of thing. And it's truly wonderful. The U.S. Forest Service struck a really great note when it came to talking about the ecosystem inside Glacier Bay, environment, global warming, all that kind of stuff. And their view, at least the view they discussed, was generally positive in the sense that, you know, they are monitoring all the changes. This protected area allows them to really study what's going on. And then it allows them to formulate possible solutions to help either slow it down, change direction a bit, whatever it happens to be. And I think what they did that I like so much, because, you know, this is an area of great importance to me, and it, in my view, should be of great importance to everyone, is that they didn't go down the guilt trip road or anything like that. What they said, though, is that here's what's happening. Here's how fast it's happening. They were very scientific about it. And here are some things we've identified that we can do if we want to slow this down, if we want to preserve these areas, if we want to get the orcas back in the bay, you know, lower the water temperature a bit so that they'll come back, you know, all that kind of stuff. And they were very detailed in their discussion about it. So you're standing there, you're looking at this magnificent scenery, you're learning about the different glaciers, you're learning about the different species that live in this park. You know, you learn about things like how the bald eagles came back from DDT because we actually did something. You know, we banned DDT, which eventually led to the population being able to come back. They talked about now there are sea otters in the bay and how that came about, and then the impact of having more otters in the bay. It was truly fascinating. So while you're there all day, and a lot of times, you know, just parked in a spot and just slowly rotating around, then you have a ranger over the PA system discussing what's going on and telling you all of this information. So it's not just taking pictures. It is actually learning about this entire ecosystem and what's going on. And I have to tell you, it just truly impressed me. And what my hope is that people who maybe aren't as focused as we are on the environment will be inspired by the combination of what they see, wanting to maybe slow down, change a bit, and learning about some things that they can do individually to help with that. So all of that was fantastic. And so my big point is on this. If you do get to do Glacier Bay, make sure that it's done right. Make sure that you learn from the Forest Service about all the stuff that I just talked about. Make sure you learn as much as you can, because it makes such a big difference when you look at your pictures in your photo library later on. It's not just a shot of a glacier or a beautiful scene or whatever it happens to be. You can really see stuff that they're discussing and you have knowledge about it. That has to become part of your research in order to get the most out of that. All right, so enough of the background stuff, but I do think it's important. Let's get to the camera gear. I mentioned smartphones at the top, and there's a reason why. I'm going to lead up to that reason right now. So the bulk of my shots were recorded with the Nikon ZF. We talked about this before I went, and the Nikkor 28 to 400 millimeter zoom. I loved not having to change lenses in the pouring rain or the blustery winds. I mean, that was such a big deal. I had a protective filter on the front. I had the lens hood on the front of the lens, so it was pretty well protected. I carried towels with me in my backpack so that when I came in from a shoot, when let's say we're going to get back in the van and we're going to go to a different location, I was able to wipe everything down. And it just worked really well. And I loved not having to open up the camera, you know, out in the field in this really challenging weather at times. I did use the 26 millimeter prime for some interiors because it was a bit faster. And I just like the way that lens shoots. But for the most part, honestly, it was the 28 to 400 millimeter. Let me tell you how that breaks down. So I'm looking at my library. Now, the way that I did my library is I use Capture One Pro and I pre-cull the shots. In other words, not everything that's on my memory card gets into my photo library. Now, when I get home, I back everything up on, you know, external drives and all that stuff. But what actually goes into Capture One Pro is filtered even before I do the import. So that's why for the whole 10 days I was gone, I have something like 580 images in my library from Alaska and Vancouver. That's because I filtered out all the other stuff. And they're still on the memory card, so go on the hard drive, yada, yada, yada. But those 580 shots, those are the shots that I want, that I like, that I'm working with. Now, when we look at those, I did a little analyzing of the metadata. And again, this is going to relate to the iPhone here in a moment. At 20 millimeters, I had 6 frames. At 26 millimeters, I had 49 frames. So I did do some nice interior shooting. We got to go inside some lodges. We got to go into a carving room where they do the totems. We got to go into a lot of really neat stuff. And that 26 millimeter was fantastic in there. So I do have 49 shots that made the cut with that lens. At 28 millimeters, so now we're talking about the 28 to 400 millimeter lens. At 28 millimeters, I had 105 shots. Between 30 millimeters and 70 millimeters, I had 180 shots. Between 71 millimeters and 105, I had 75 shots. Between 106 and 200 millimeters, I had 94 shots. And between 201 millimeters and 400 millimeters, I had 70 shots, okay, that made the cut. So you can see that there's a pretty wide range there. A lot of times, like for instance, when we go to Costa Rica in January, a lot of times I'm going to be at 400 or 420, depending on which camera I take. This, though, I was zooming a lot. I was framing in camera, and I didn't necessarily always want to be super tight. So, for instance, when I was in Juneau, we hiked out to the Mendenhall Glacier, and there were falls out there, too. And I got some good angles in that. It's a state park there, I believe. And I got some good angles. But sometimes I would shoot at 400 millimeters. Sometimes I'd shoot at 200 millimeters. Sometimes I'd shoot at 28 millimeters. It really depended. And I was very aware that I wanted a variety of shots. I didn't want to just fall into some sort of visual rut. I wanted to vary the angles, vary the scene, vary the focal lengths, vary everything, go up, down, all that sort of stuff. So having that one lens on there that allowed me to change those focal lengths so easily without having to change out lens. And it was wet in Juneau. It's almost always wet in Juneau, I guess. But it was really wet and the wind was blowing. This was not the time to be changing lenses, but I didn't want to be stuck with just one lens on there at a particular focal length. So this is where that variety of focal lengths came in so handy. And that's really reflected in my library here. When you take a look at, I had a lot of shots at a lot of different focal lengths. And that's because I was able to zoom. In the 3-star collection, and these are the shots that I really like and work on. These are my favorites. I have 121 images. So basically 1 out of 5 made it into the 3-star collection. 40 of those were recorded at focal lengths beyond 120 millimeters. Out of the 121, 40 of them were beyond 120 millimeters. That'll become important in a minute about the iPhone. And then I also have a collection of black and white photos that I captured with the ZF using one of two profiles. I use the deep tone monotone profile a lot, and that comes inside the ZF. That's one of the options that are built in. And then I also have a film emulation that I've loaded for Tri-X. And I used both of them depending. Those shots are amazing out of the camera. Now, I was talking to another photographer when I was there, and I was showing him some of the black and white stuff, and he loved it, looking at it on the LCD. But he goes, you know, I could just go ahead and convert afterwards, you know, in Lightroom or whatever. And I said, yeah, of course. Yes, of course you can, you know, and that's a great way to go. What I didn't say to him, what I was thinking is, you know what, though, when you're shooting in really great black and white, let's say with a Tri-X film simulation, it is motivating. I mean, you look through that viewfinder and you see that shot and you adjust the exposure and you get it the way you want and you take it and you look at it and you go, you want to take another shot right away. This is like some sort of cocaine for photography when you really get rolling on this. And in my mind, I wanted to say to him, it's not the same converting afterwards. It's really not the same. You know, you're not seeing the world in black and white. You're not getting jacked about it. You know, and you just go after, well, maybe I'll convert this one or maybe I'll convert that one. It's a whole different thing. Yeah, obviously, this is RAW plus JPEG, right? And so JPEGs are the film simulations. I'm using the JPEGs. That album in Capture One Pro, that black and white album, are the JPEGs. And I have made some tweaks to them, but generally speaking, they're pretty much the way that I shot them. And if I wanted to take the RAW file and go back and do stuff, I could. We all know that. But that album is JPEGs, and they are beautiful. Oh my gosh. Wooden docks in Ketchikan, just so much good stuff. A twilight scene in Vancouver with the moon waxing, just rising above the city, and I was on the 15th floor out on a balcony. I mean, there's just some badass stuff. So that was also a big part of having, for me, either the Nikon, or I could have done the same thing with the Olympus. Having that camera really allowed me to get a whole collection of shots that I don't think I would have got otherwise. So I've just given you this big data dump, and I didn't even get into things like everything was geotagged, because I had SnapBridge running on my iPhone, so every shot I shot got geotagged. My resolution was 6,048 by 4,032. I had ISOs go as high as 25,600, depending on the situation that I was in. So why do I give you all this information, right? Why am I giving you all this stuff, other than that we're all gearhead photographers? Well, because in my mind, this 10-day photo shoot would have been impossible with just my iPhone 15 Pro Max. You know, I went back and I counted. I did take 140 pictures with my iPhone, but they're exactly what you thought they'd be. There's selfies there, which are fun, meals, signs, grab shots, you know, all that kind of stuff. So they're fantastic. Would I want that, you know, as my only memory of this 10-day adventure? No way. You know, no way. I would not want to come home with only those types of images. But yet, that is what almost everyone had on this adventure. And I was blown away by this, because this is a photographer's dream, this adventure. And I'm not just talking about on the ship. Of course, you expect iPhones only on the ship. And I have shots when we're in Glacier Bay, everyone crowded out on the bow, you know, with holding their iPhones up and, you know, taking those shots. Okay, yeah, you expect that, right? Those people, a lot of those people never even go on shore, never go on an excursion. But what blew me away was on the excursions, people who paid money to go out into the middle of nowhere with a photo guide were shooting with smartphones. It blew me away. On one excursion in Ketchikan, I was the only person out of six on that excursion. I was the only person that had an interchangeable lens camera. And this is going on. This isn't just some weird thing that happened, because the photo guides, they're very adept at teaching people how to get great shots with their iPhones. And I really appreciated that. And it was fun to listen to them show them some of the tricks. You know, they showed them the flowing water trick and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And it was cool and they were really helpful. But what I would do is I would just say to the guide, you know, he just tell by looking at me, he knew that I didn't want to stand there during these little tutorials. So I just say, you know, just flag me down when we're ready to go back. I'll stay within reach here. And then I'll be back at the time you tell me. And I'm going to go take some pictures elsewhere. And so I would do that. And, you know, I never missed the boat, never missed the van. And I always got back on time. I was a good workshop participant for sure. I had to just get away from all of that. And I was stunned because, you know, you pay money for these excursions and they're really geared for people who want different shots, who want to take great shots, who want something different than what you would get if you just stepped off the pier. And yet I saw almost nothing but smartphones the whole time. It was astounding. And I just couldn't help thinking, what a waste. I mean, for these folks, I mean, you can get an interchangeable lens camera. You can get a nice little Olympus EM10 Mark IV or something with a terrific lens or two for, you know what, $700, $800, something like that. You're going on a trip of a lifetime. There's a lot of things that I noticed were different. Now, I don't know if all of you know my history, and it's a varied history. There's a lot to know. But during one phase, I taught photography on cruise ships. And this was a phase when I wanted to see more of the world than I could afford to travel on my own. I would work photography conferences on ship. I worked Macmania cruises, stuff like that. And those were fantastic because while we're at sea, I would teach classes. And when we were in port, I was on my own. And I used to teach with guys like Ben Long. When we get into port, we would have a plan and we would get the heck out of there and go take pictures. And then I also preferred warm water destinations and I'm an avid snorkeler. I love snorkeling. So I got to snorkel Belize and all the way down Mexico and all that stuff that I wouldn't get to do otherwise because I was teaching on cruise ships. So I know how the whole cruise ship thing works. I've done it time after time after time. And it was so interesting to me because now, because of smartphones, people just aren't carrying cameras and they're just missing these photo opportunities right and left. My iPhone Pro Max with the 5X telephoto goes, I believe, 120 millimeters. And the pictures are okay. They're okay. They're not great. I'm not super crazy about it, but sometimes I'm really glad I have that camera because I have gotten some good shots with it. But that's it, 120 millimeters, and you just feel like you're stretching everything when you use it, right? Stretching the laws of physics, even with computational photography. 120 millimeters only would not cut it on this trip, would not even come close. The things that I did with my interchangeable lens camera, there are things that I just can't do with my iPhone, as good as it is. As good as it is, there are just things I couldn't do. And then that, I'm also talking about things like shooting in the rain and stuff with an electronic viewfinder jammed up to your eye, you know, while it's raining with you, instead of having to focus or compose off an LCD. Just being able to alter the exposure and all that sort of stuff. So much easier. It was no comparison whatsoever. And one moment really crystallized this for me. It was after I had left Alaska and I was back in Vancouver, BC. And I had a hotel room at the Blue Horizon in downtown Vancouver. A fantastic place. I love this hotel. And I was on the 15th floor and they have balconies. One of the reasons why I love this hotel, they have balconies with doors that open and you can go outside and stand on the balcony, or in my case, drag a chair out there and sit on the balcony. And, you know, I was very much in balcony mode still because I had one on the ship and spent so much time out there. Even if I had a down jacket and a sailor's cap on, I was out there on that balcony. So I was sitting out there on the last evening before I came back, and it was twilight. and the lights were starting to come up on the city, and this beautiful waxing moon came up over a modern apartment building. And I was sitting there with the camera in my lap, and I composed the shot. I had to rack it all the way out to 400 millimeters. Camera handled the shot no problem. Got this beautiful shot of the moon in the apartment building. And then, you know, then I was taking shots of the city itself coming to life at twilight. And then I'd go, you know, I'd narrow back to 28 millimeters and do those shots. And then I shot some in black and white. And I was sitting there looking at the pictures on the back of the LCD. And I was saying to myself, I am so glad I brought this camera on this trip. I am so glad, you know, to have this right now, because I know a lot of people don't, and a lot of people just would never be able to get these shots that I'm getting right now. And for me, it just affirmed, you know, so much of how I feel that the smartphones definitely have a place in our photography. You know, I'm not anti-smartphone because I talk about them all the time. I love them, but they have a role, and that role is backup camera, documentation, selfies, things like that, right? Things that, you know, you always have a camera with you, things. And they're fantastic for that. But people have stretched that into something, trying to make it the only camera that they take, which still could work in certain situations, but not on situations like this, but not on trips like this. And that's where I feel like so many people on this trip really missed the boat. All right, a couple things happened while I was gone. Oh my gosh. Just so you know, I was like on a news blackout. I was offline. I was off the grid, basically. And it was wonderful. But stuff happened, right? And one of the things that happened, speaking of smartphones, is the iPhone 16, right? They had that presentation, and it has that new camera button, which looks pretty good. So I'm looking at this article here. I'm on DP Review right now, and it's dpreview.com. Let me just read you a little bit about their iPhone article here. Apple has announced the iPhone 16 Pro and 16 Pro Max, which included a dedicated camera control button, the A18 Pro system on chip, and larger displays. The company says that the 16 Pro includes a new 48 megapixel fusion camera with a second generation quad pixel sensor. According to Apple, it has 2 times faster readout than the previous version, allowing for no shutter lag. The Pro Max's 5X lens has also come to the regular iPhone 16 Pro, replacing the 3X camera that was on the previous generation. And, you know, that 5X, as I was talking about earlier, it's nice to have on there, and I do use it. I do use it, but, oh my gosh, sometimes it is no substitution for a regular camera. Anyway, I'm going backwards here. Let's go back to the article. The 16 Pro's ultra-wide camera now also has a 48-megapixel sensor, up from 12 megapixels on the previous generation, and the company has updated its photo styles feature, offering more control over color. You'll also be able to change the style after capturing the image. They used to be baked in, no longer baked in. All right, and then they go on about some more technical stuff here, all sorts of good stuff. The camera looks good, and the camera control button looks good. I mean, one of the things that they did that I think is really nice, it has a half press function. So you can half press the camera control button to lock in exposure and focus, like we do with our regular cameras. And then, you know, keep pressing to take the shot. I think that is wonderful. I love that feature, and I look forward to using it. But I'm not going to have the iPhone 16. I have the 15, and I'm just going to stand pat. But someday in the future, I will use it. So this looks like a terrific camera. They're expensive, as we all know. And it's going to cost you well over $1,000 for one of these babies. And I think it's a good upgrade, especially if you have an iPhone 12 or 13. I think it's a no-brainer. If you have a 14 or 15, I think you can wait. Honestly, the 14s and 15s are really good cameras. Unless you just have to have the latest and greatest or the camera control button. But that happened while I was gone. I missed the whole presentation. I haven't watched the video or anything. I'm not in the market for an iPhone right now, but it looks good and it looks fun. All right, well, lots of other stuff happened too. Nikon introduced yet another 50 millimeter, this time 50 1.4 in Z mount. I mean, honestly, how many 50 millimeters do we need? I'm not sure. Apparently 1.2 and 1.8 are not enough. You have to have a 1.4 as well. Okay, fantastic. So a lot of that stuff happened as well. Leica introduced the M11 that doesn't have an LCD screen on the back, but still costs $10,000. So that's all good. It's a beautiful camera. So all these things happened while I was floating around in Glacier Bay. And it was fun to read about it when I got back. All right, to give a little Virtual Camera Club news, I want to give a shout out to our Inner Circle members who kept things going while I was gone. Thank you so much, guys and gals, for continuing to post pictures and keep conversations flowing and all that. However, I'm back now, so I want to pick up the pace just a little bit, alrighty? Our Inner Circle members have their own site where they share pictures, talk about things, and, you know, it's a great camera club. Birds of a feather, indeed. And if you want to become a member of the Inner Circle, all you have to do is click on the Patreon tile that's on all the pages of the Digital Story. You can nose around a bit, sign up there, and I hope you do, because this is a great group of photographers. And finally, I want to give a shout out to our friends at Red River Paper, longest running sponsor of The Digital Story. And I am telling you right now, I cannot wait to print, and especially some of the black and white stuff. I mean, the color stuff, of course. But some of this black and white stuff that I got with the deep tone monotone and the Tri-X is so pretty on the LCD. And I just want to see how it looks on paper. I want to get some really great Red River paper. Something that has just a little bit of finish to it, but not too much. Something that has some good texture, and really see if I can make those images shine. And of course, you know, the paper you choose is such a huge part of the final interpretation of the photograph in terms of cool tone versus warm tone, in terms of texture, in terms of how much coating it has, you know, how deep are those blacks, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I am going to pick some fantastic paper and make some fine art cards for sure, but I want to make some big prints as well. And all of this is because of our good friends, Red River Paper. Click on their tile. It's on every page of the Digital Story. You can get free shipping using the discount code that's there. Holidays are coming. You want to have some paper in stock, and Red River Paper is the place to go. And a big thanks to them for sponsoring our podcast. All right, it's going to do it for me today. I'm going to have to settle down a bit after my trip from Alaska, because I'm getting ready for Durango in 2 weeks. I'll be back next week with a new podcast. Until then, get out there, take some pictures, stay safe. See you next Tuesday. Bye-bye now.